This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
And where are you presently employed?
And Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago.
Okay. And was that the same place you were employed back in July 2015 when you encountered the Kowalski family?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what is Lurie Children's Hospital?
It's a pediatric children's hospital.
Did you review anything in connection with preparing for today?
Yes.
What did you review?
My notes.
And those are your Lurie Children's notes?
Yes.
Can you give me the benefit of your training and education from the time that you graduated from high school or from college through any types of advanced training or degrees you have in your chosen field?
Sure. I received my bachelor's at West Virginia University. Following that, I went and received a doctorate in clinical psychology at the University of Florida. I completed a clinical internship here at Lurie Children's. I also completed a postdoctoral fellowship at Lurie Children's.
Let me ask you this. What is your current title?
Director of Training in Psychology.
Okay. Is that, do you have a focus in the pediatric realm?
I do.
What about back in 2015 when you were handling the care of Maya Kowalski? What was your title back then?
Pediatric psychologist.
And what type of role does the pediatric psychologist play in a patient like Maya Kowalski?
The role that I played was I was an attending psychologist on our consultation liaison team.
And what are the types of things that you will do in furtherance of those duties?
Generally, our attending teams would receive consults from our medical colleagues, and we would interview and assess families to answer the questions that they had requested. And if applicable, we might make recommendations in those cases.
Okay. And did you have a PhD at the time that you cared for Maya Kowalski?
I did.
Okay. What other types of degrees did you have at that point?
I also have a master's degree, but the PhD is probably more relevant.
Well, and what's the PhD in?
Clinical psychology.
I'm just curious, just if you could just describe generally what the field of clinical psychology is.
It's a field that aims to, it's kind of broad, individuals who are engaged in the study and potentially treatment and evaluation of individuals who have psychological concerns.
Did you review any other documents, literature, medical records other than what we've described in preparation of today?
I did not.
How was it that you came to be involved as a psychologist for Maya Kowalski?
I was a member of the consultation liaison team, and I happened to receive the consultation request.
Based on my review of the history and physical, which is Exhibit 2 at LCH 140 through 145, and I'm going to put that up for you right now. It appears to me, based on my review of this, that a Dr. Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, was the attending physician. And I'll scroll down here to the bottom of the H&P here. Do you see where it says Elizabeth A. Byrne, M.D.?
Yes.
And if a pediatric attending physician wants psychology involved, can you walk me through how in 2015 they would get someone like you involved in the workup of a patient?
Yeah, generally the process would be that the physician would put in an order for a psychiatric consult, and a member of the psychiatric consultation team would receive that consult and do an evaluation and make treatment recommendations if applicable. It's the general process.
Continuing here with Dr. Byrne's history and physical, which can be found on LCH 140 through LCH 145, I wanted to ask you about a few entries in there and see if you can tell me what the significance of these entries are okay. In your field as a pediatric psychologist. On page 143 in the impression section, Dr. Byrne notes here, quote, her exam is not necessarily consistent with her history, which raises concern for a psychiatric component to her presentation and specifically conversion disorder. Do you see that?
I see that.
Okay. So I'm drawing you back to the portion that I just quoted into the record. Her exam is not necessarily consistent with her history, which raises concern for a psychiatric component to her presentation and specifically conversion disorder. My question is, as a clinical psychologist, what does that statement from Dr. Burns signify to you?
Okay. I mean, I don't want to kind of infer or speak for Dr. Byrne, but if I generally were to see a comment like that in a medical record and had received a consultation request, it would be consistent with wanting to get our team involved to further evaluate in that area for psychiatric components.
In this phrase in other portions of the chart, psychiatric component to her presentation, what does that signify to you?
Again, generally speaking, psychiatric component to me would signify that there might be additional psychiatric contributors to a patient's presentation that might be in addition to or related or not related to other factors that might be contributing to the presentation.
And likewise, there's a reference here to, quote, conversion disorder. Can you please define what conversion disorder is?
Yeah, so generally speaking, conversion disorder is a psychiatric diagnosis that would indicate that there are psychological or psychiatric contributors to a particular presentation, which would, on the surface, appear more physical in nature.
Do you have any independent recollection, separate apart from the notes, of your interactions with Maya Kowalski or her family members back in July of 2015?
No.
So it's fair to say you're going to be guided more or less by the records. Okay. It says here at the very bottom where my cursor is, mom reports in recent hospitalizations, Maya has been resistant to separation from her mother. She does not like for conversations regarding her health to happen outside of the room and does not want her mother to leave her alone. Do you see that?
I see that.
What does that signify to you as someone who practices in your field?
Again, it's not my note, so I don't want to infer Dr. Burns' note, kind of that thought process. I think independent of other data, it's just a comment.
One other thing that I see repeated throughout Maya's medical records here at Lurie's is this next line here where it says, quote, she intermittently moans but is distractible when talking about school, her friends, or her summer plans. Do you see that quote?
I do.
I've seen the word distractible referenced with respect to Maya's relationship. What does that term mean to you as a clinical psychologist?
Again, it's not my note, but you know, if when I see that somebody's distractible, I generally speaking would think that that means that if they were presenting with pain and then something else can take their attention away from the pain.
In distractibility in the setting of a patient with either chronic pain or suspected psychiatric components, what does distractibility mean to you as a clinical psychologist?
Generally speaking, again, I would interpret that as somebody whose attention can be drawn to things other than pain.
And why is that clinically significant to someone in your field?
And as an isolated piece of information, probably no one piece of information is, you know, kind of like.
At the very bottom of this addendum, do you see where my cursor is? And it says, quote, given these findings, there is concern for an underlying psychiatric etiology such as conversion disorder. Can you break that sentence down to me and tell me what is being described there by Dr. Byrne?
So generally speaking, I read that as Dr. Byrne felt that there might be a psychiatric contribution to the patient's presentation. And that might be an area that Dr. Byrne might have had thoughts or concerns about. But for my purpose, generally speaking, if I receive a consult like this, it's just reason for consult.
Okay. Well, since there was an objection, why don't you describe how you get involved in a patient's care, such as Maya Kowalski back in the July 2015 timeframe at Lurie Children's?
Yeah, so generally speaking, for the consultation service, the medical psychiatry consultation service, we receive orders, requests for consults from our medical colleagues to get involved in specific cases.
Gotcha. Now I'd like to draw your attention to our next exhibit here, which is going to be at LCH 189 through LCH 192. And it appears to be a consult note by a Claudio S. Rivera that is subsequently electronically signed by you on July 23, 2015. Do you see the Mr. Rivera's note from 7/22/2015.
I see that.
My first question would be, who is Claudio Rivera?
Claudio was a psychology intern working with me at the time.
And in this case, it looks like you electronically signed this exhibit we're looking at back in July 23, 2015 at 11:04. I'll scroll down there for you so you can see what I'm talking about. I'm 192. Do you see there? Right where my cursor is.
I see that.
Okay. And so fair to say you would have reviewed Mr. Rivera's note and then signed off on it?
That's the general practice.
So you see on 189 here where it says psychologist attending note. You're the psychologist attending?
Yes.
Okay. And it says here, I saw Maya and her mother and reviewed the medical chart. Do you see that?
I see that.
And that's part of the process I think you just described about how you get involved and work a patient up, correct?
Correct.
And you also indicate here, I discussed this case with Mr. Rivera. That's Claudio Rivera, the psych intern that you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
And it appears here is as of the date of service, you agreed with the consult, assessment, and recommendations as outlined. Do you see that?
I see that.
Okay, is that a correct statement?
Correct.
Based on your documentation here, what was the reason for the consultation with the pediatric psychology department there at Lurie's back in July of 2015?
Yeah, so what I'm seeing in the note is that the medical psychology consult service was consulted to assess for psychological origin of pain symptoms, specifically conversion disorder.
And when you say psychological origin of pain syndromes, what do you mean there?
Generally speaking, we're thinking about contributors that are outside of a purely kind of physical contribution to a pain presentation.
Okay. Now, looking through here, the history of presenting illness, medical surgical history, allergies, do you know where you would have obtained that information back in 2015 for placement into the chart?
Yeah, so generally speaking, the information that is noted in our consultation write-up is generally brought from review of the medical record, interview with the patient, frequently interview with a family or other relevant parties.
Would that also include family social history that we see at the bottom of 190?
Yes, generally speaking.
Question, what is the mental status exam portion of this note? Why is this there? What are you describing?
Yeah, so generally speaking, this part of our note includes the outward behavioral observations that were observed at the time of the interview and the assessment, both in a narrative form, as you see at the top, and then in very specific areas as are listed below that.
Okay, and in there, second sentence, it says here, quote, she was casually dressed and slight of build. And then after that, it says, quote, during the consult, she sat up in a wheelchair with support from her mother prior to being carried to her bed. She lay face down on the bed for the majority of the consult. Do you see that?
I see that.
What is the clinical significance of placing that entry into the chart?
Generally speaking, we just tried to describe the presentation of the patient at the time we did the assessment.
And continuing on after that sentence, it says, quote, she presented as distressed at times, which consisted of her moaning. She appeared able to regulate her distress, specifically when responding to from the psych consult team. What is being described in this portion of your note?
Yeah, so what it looks like Mr. Rivera is describing is that she presented as moaning at times, which we interpreted as distressed. But when specific questions or comments were made by our team, she was able to regulate or kind of manage that distress at some way.
And why for a patient like Maya Kowalski, would that be a clinically relevant thing to put into a medical chart?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it meant that, you know, we would include that to indicate that she does have some ability to manage her pain symptoms, or there are perhaps periods of our observation of her at which she appeared to be able to manage her pain.
And then continuing on with this paragraph, it says, quote, Maya was able to respond to providers without attending to pain symptoms. Do you see that?
I see that.
the best of your knowledge, what is Mr. Rivera describing here in this note that you signed off on?
Yeah, so what I see there is that when Maya was responding, her pain symptoms decreased.
I'd like to jump forward a little bit on this note. We've gone through a little bit of the mental status exam, and then we get to the impressions section here, which is at the bottom of 191 and then runs over to 192. Impression, you see where it says Maya is a 9-year-old girl who was admitted to LCH for pain and weakness following a transfer from an outside hospital. Do you see that?
Yes.
And then it says down here DSM-4 diagnoses. That's what is the DSM-4?
The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 4th edition. It is the listing of psychiatric diagnoses that was standard practice at the time of this consult.
Well, I know we're up to DSM-5 now, but back at the time, it seems like we were on DSM-4.
Yes, that's correct.
What is this DSM-4 diagnoses section here describing on LCH-192?
Yeah, so generally speaking, that section describes our initial diagnoses at the time of our initial consult.
And what were your initial diagnoses as reflected here?
Yeah, so on axis one, the diagnosis was psychological factors affecting physical condition, ruling out conversion disorder, ruling out an anxiety disorder. No diagnosis indicated at that time for axis two, allergies, asthma, recent onset of pain, numbing, weakness, generalized to her body. On axis three, mild problems with social environment, axis four, and a global assessment at axis five of 41 to 50, which is indicative of serious symptoms and functional impairment.
Let me take you back to this axis one. Is the diagnosis psychological factors affecting physical condition?
That's a diagnosis.
And what does that mean if you're trying to explain this to perhaps a lay juror who doesn't have the level of expertise that you do in this field?
Yeah, generally speaking, that indicates that there are psychological contributors that are impacting an individual's physical presentation.
When it says below what we just talked about, RO conversion disorder, what does that mean?
Generally speaking, those are on our differential and things we are continuing to rule in or out, but have not yet.
So in other words...
So generally speaking, it's not a confirmed diagnosis, but it's part of the broader differential under consideration.
Hasn't been ruled in, hasn't been ruled out yet. As of this.
Generally speaking, that's correct.
Let me ask you the same question. When it says R/O anxiety disorder, what does that mean?
Same thing. Okay. Same as the conversion disorder answer.
It hasn't been ruled in, hasn't been ruled out yet.
Generally speaking, yes.
And is that part of the reason why the psychiatric team was involved in this workout to rule in or out certain things like conversion or anxiety?
Yeah, as the consult note indicated, it looks like we were consulted to assess for psychological origin or contributors to the pain.
And as of this date, are you leaning towards a finding that there are some psychological factors that affect the physical condition?
That was the diagnosis at the time of that initial consult.
And then I think you made some recommendations at this point, too. Can you mind describing what those were?
Yeah, so I think if you scroll further down in my note, in Mr. Rivera's note, it indicates our initial recommendations.
Okay. And I'm looking at that section now, and I think I have it up on screen share. It says, consider rehab model for treatment consultation from RIC.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so generally speaking, we're looking... we're making a recommendation to the medical team to consider a rehabilitation model. RIC is a rehabilitation center that we frequently partnered with that, if indicated, may sometimes also come and do an independent consultation to see if they concur.
Is RIC also known as the Rehab Institute of Chicago?
Yes.
Okay. And what do you mean by rehab model? What does that term mean?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it's a type of treatment that would, it's a little bit outside of my scope of practice because I don't work in a rehab setting, but generally speaking, it's a treatment and intervention model that frequently would have both medical and psychological or psychiatric providers, as well as an emphasis on things like physical therapy or occupational therapy or other types of specialized treatments if indicated for the patient. With a function typically with a focus typically on increasing function.
And on the second prong of your recommendations, it says here, continue ongoing assessment for med psych and consider non-pharmacologic interventions for pain management along with parent support. Do you see that?
Yes.
Can you please explain what Mr. Rivera is describing in that portion of his recommendation section?
Sorry. So he is saying that, you know, we will continue to be involved in the case. And it's for the medical team, the attending medical provider, to consider, you know, it might be appropriate for us to start to introduce some of these non-pharmacologic interventions that might benefit the patient in their pain management and ability to manage and moderate their pain experience.
And then non-pharmacologic, that just means no medication intervention, am I correct?
Yes, it indicates, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist. I do not prescribe. So it indicates the types of interventions that are appropriate to our scope of practice. Okay.
And then it says down here, med psych, which we just said was you, is in support of consults with art therapy, music therapy, and child life. Do you see that?
I do.
Why were those three modalities something that the med psych team was in support of?
Yeah, I don't recall specifically, but generally speaking, we would see those types of services as being beneficial if we felt that, you know, additional kind of structure, additional type of opportunities for engagement in other services, distractions, scheduling, kind of getting other people involved to help provide some assistance to a patient. There's lots of reasons why we might think about those three specifically. But generally speaking, they're positive, well-received types of interventions for our pediatric patients that can provide structure to their day, as well as have a therapeutic emphasis that might also be helpful to patients like Maya, who seem to be experiencing pain.
And then the last recommendation prong here, it says, consider multidisciplinary team coordinated care conference to provide Maya and family with impressions and treatment recommendations. What is being described in that sentence?
Yeah, so generally speaking, that would indicate that we felt it might be beneficial just to essentially bring the providers in the room together to talk about our impressions and recommendations and to present that to the family in a joint manner.
And so it's not foreign to you at Lurie's to refer to a collection of treating providers as part of a, quote, team?
It is not.
No, I'm correct that this is a progress note authored by you on July 22, 2015?
Yes.
And it says service psychiatry. One question I had here about you, you're not a psychiatrist, you're a psychologist by trade, I think?
Yes.
Let's go through this first note here and just kind of dissect it a little bit. You see where it says, quote, our team met with Maya and her mother today in response to consult requests to assess for psychological contributors to Maya's current presentation of symptoms and expressions of pain.
I see that.
So, Dr. Lowry, can you please describe what you are explaining here in this first sentence in your progress note?
So, generally speaking, that first sentence is a reiteration of what we did that day.
Okay. Which was essentially what?
We met with the patient, we met with her mother in response to the consult order from our medical peers for the purposes of assessing for psychological contributors to the pain presentation.
In the next sentence here, you write, quote, Maya endorsed significant pain with physical presentations of moaning, grimacing, and writhing. What are you describing in that portion of your note?
So that appears to me to be a reiteration of what we described in more detail in the behavioral observations of the full consult.
Okay. So you had an opportunity to physically observe this finding as well per your note?
Per my note, it says our team met with, so.
Oh. Are you part of the team?
I'm part of the team.
Okay. And then you say concurrently, Maya was able to also cease pain expressions, entirely track and participate in conversation. What are you describing there?
Yeah, so I read my note as that Maya was also at times able to present without that grimacing, moaning, writhing types of, you know, behaviors, and was able to appropriately participate in the conversation and the questions that our team asked of her.
Why don't we go down to the second paragraph here, where you see where it says our full consult will follow, but our initial impressions at this time suggest that psychological factors could be contributing, possibly through maintenance of pain symptoms in response to an initial stressor or physical change. Do you see that?
I see that.
Kind of break that sentence down for me and tell me what this sentence means to somebody who might not have a PhD in clinical psychology.
Okay. So generally speaking, that sentence is essentially a narrative reiteration of our diagnosis that we had made in the full consult to follow, that we did think that there were psychological contributors, likely, to Maya's pain experience. And we weren't sure, so hence the possibly. But one way in which sometimes that can present is to continue pain symptoms, even if it's in response to a physical contribution initially.
Can you please summarize what your five recommendations for Maya were as of July 22, 2015?
Yes. So our first recommendation was, you know, just to support our medical colleagues in continuing to do their workup of contributions to the pain. The second recommendation, consistent with what we've discussed, was our support of considering consults from our colleagues in art therapy, music therapy, and child life. The third recommendation, as previously discussed, was to consider a rehab model for treatment and to consult our colleagues in the rehab space. Our fourth recommendation was to consider, again, kind of bringing the full team together to discuss this diagnosis, these diagnoses, these treatment recommendations with the family. And then the fifth recommendation, typo there, was that we'll continue essentially to follow along the case with our medical colleagues as long as they, you know, will continue to follow.
And it appears there was a first inpatient visit that was conducted. The social worker, Ms. Allen here, where my cursor is, says, quote, patient woke up during conversation with mother and became tearful, calling for mother to return to the hospital room. Does that seem like it could be something that's significant to a member of a med psych team such as yourself? Yeah, just like this statement here, patient woke up during conversation with mother and became tearful, calling for mother to return to the hospital room. Is that something that you encounter frequently with pediatric patients?
You know, as an isolated statement, it's not particularly meaningful. We work with kids, and sometimes kids get upset when their parents are or aren't present.
Later on, during a second inpatient visit down here, you see where it says, quote, patient abruptly stated in voice deeper than regular voice, quote, I don't do gymnastics anymore. Mm-hmm. And then later on, the patient stated, I can't be distracted. Distraction doesn't work on me. My question is, this reference to distraction, is that similar to what you previously described earlier in your testimony?
You know, since it wasn't a note from our team, I can't really comment on whether they meant it in the same way that I meant it or not.
167, I believe this to be your second note. Do you see the note that I'm talking about here, Dr. Lowry? It's Kelly Lowry, PhD, 7-23-15-14-55. Do you see that?
I see that.
The very end here, it says, you know, you guys are going to try some parenting strategies likely to reduce unintentional reinforcement of pain behaviors. What does that mean?
So generally speaking, there are ways that an adult or peer can respond to a pain presentation that has the potential to decrease or increase or maintain pain expressions. And so I read that as, generally speaking, we were likely thinking that some of that level of intervention might be beneficial.
I wanted to draw your attention to another note here from Lori Allen, the social worker. It's from 7/23/15. There's a section in this note where the social worker is indicating that she has accompanied Dr. Byrne and Dr. Whaley for morning rounds. And then down here, it says Dr. Byrne explained that patient's pain is psychogenic paren conversion disorder. Do you see that?
See that?
Can you please describe or define actually what psychogenic paren conversion disorder and paren means?
Yeah, so again, I don't want to infer Dr. Byrne's work.
In your experience as a licensed clinical psychologist, if you see a doctor note, Dr. Byrne explained that patient's pain is psychogenic paren conversion disorder and paren, what does that mean to you as a licensed clinical psychologist?
Generally speaking, psychogenic means that there's a psychiatric or psychological contribution. And conversion disorder, I interpret as we previously discussed and defined.
And so do you recognize this as your note here? It says on LCH 154, electronically signed by Kelly Lowry on 7/24/15.
I do.
It indicates here, I met with the family this afternoon through participation in a multidisciplinary care conference. Am I correct in assuming that was the team get together with the family and various providers that you were referencing earlier?
I believe so.
Quote, in summary, our initial impressions at this time suggest that psychological factors could be contributing, possibly through maintenance of pain syndrome symptoms in response to an initial stressor or physical change. And again, what are you describing in that clause?
So again, that's a reiteration of our diagnosis of psychological factors affecting physical condition.
And it looks like you list out 1, 2, 3, 4 recommendations for this patient. Do you see those in your note?
I see that.
How do those recommendations change from your previous recommendations that you documented?
I do not believe that they did.
It says here, right about where my cursor is, quote, had a care conference with Maya's mother, father via telephone, social work, patient relations, and psychology to discuss the plan of care. Is that the multidisciplinary conference that you referenced earlier in your testimony?
I believe so.
And again, anything we're talking about today is a fresh recollection of this patient specifically, independent from what you may have reviewed in the chart?
I do not have independent recollection.
Dr. Byrne says here, quote, I discussed with Maya's mother that I believe that there is no organic cause to her symptoms. Do you know what Dr. Byrne is referencing in that portion of her addendum?
Again, you know, I don't want to interpret her words for her, but generally I read that as the medical team has determined that they do not feel that there's a kind of physical contributor to Maya's pain or Maya's presentation of symptoms.
Okay. And then it also says here, given her extensive symptoms, recommend intensive multidisciplinary care involving physical therapy, psychology, and pain specialists. Do you see that?
I see that.
In patients similar to Maya, is that the type of treatment modality that you've seen recommended on occasion?
Yeah, generally speaking, that seems a consistent or reasonable recommendation.
Just so the record's clear, I will be introducing this as an exhibit as well. It's Maya Kowalski's discharge summary from Lurie Children's Hospital. It's dated July 24, 2015, and it's at LCH 128 through 134. And I believe it is signed by Dr. Byrne on LCH 134. Do you have any role or involvement in preparing a patient's discharge summary, doctor?
No.
You know how Dr. Byrne would have gone through and prepared her discharge summary?
Not specifically, no.
Throughout the discharge summary and elsewhere, and I'll pull up an example on 130 here under neuro, it says alert, interactive, intermittently screaming and crying, but distractible with questioning. Do you see that?
I see that.
Okay, is that consistent with some of the previous entries you've seen regarding the patient having, you know, some screaming and moaning and crying, but would also be distractible when talking about other topics?
That seems consistent.
And Dr. Byrne reports patient was seen by child psychology during hospital stay. Do you see that?
I see that.
Am I correct in assuming that child psychology is you and your department?
Correct.
And then Dr. Burns says, quote, their opinion as follows, and she quotes a fairly long passage there. Do you see that long passage?
I see that.
You recognize the opinions from the child psychology group that appear in this note to be the recommendations that you gave for this patient that we've already previously discussed?
Yes.
And then towards the end, impression and plan, we're getting towards the end here. Dr. Byrne notes, quote, her exam is not necessarily consistent with her history, which raises concern for a psychiatric component to her presentation and specifically conversion disorder. Do you see that?
I see that.
And I think we talked about similar notes in the chart related to this before, correct?
Correct.
Based on your review of the notes at issue, do you agree or disagree with this impression from Dr. Byrne that I just quoted?
So in my review of my records, our diagnosis was psychological factors affecting physical condition, and we were still ruling in or out conversion disorder. But we had commented that we felt that psychological factors were contributing or could be contributing.
Hey, one other thing, I'd like to just show you the consent form that the Kowalski, that Maya's mother signed in this case, and see if you recognize it as the type of consent form that they use at Lurie's. I'm going to mark this as an exhibit as well, LCH 152 to 153. Have you ever seen a consent to examination and treatment form from Lurie Children's Hospital before, Dr. Lowry?
Yes.
Okay. Is this what I'm showing you here, the type of consent form that a parent or patient would sign upon admission to Lurie Children's?
I'm not able to read the entire note, but it appears to be consistent with our consents.
Okay. And I see in one portion here, it says, I hereby authorize Lurie Children's and its medical staff to take photographs, video, digital, and other images of me, my child, for treatment, education, and research purposes, end quote. Do you see that portion?
I see that.
Are there times as a clinical psychologist where it might be helpful to take a picture or a video of a child?
Yeah, there might be situations where that would be beneficial.
All right. Has anything today, doctor, triggered any recollection outside of the notes that we testified about? Because, you know, I typically talk to people about their independent recollection and what they charted. Did anything today bring up anything independent?
I do not have independent recollection.
Maya Kowalski was your patient for a period of time in the summer of 2015, was she not?
We were consulted to make an assessment of her.
And through the course of this, you spent approximately how long with her, would you say?
Oh, personally. Can we pause for a moment? I don't
Less recall. Than an hour?
I don't recall. Yeah.
Hey, members of the jury, let me turn on the lights. I am told that it actually completes what we're going to be playing of that deposition. So I think this is probably a good time for a break. Do not discuss this case amongst yourselves. Do not do any investigation and receive no information. Let's try to take a 10-minute break.
All right.
Everyone can be seated. So everything that was played was actually your designation?
Yeah. There may have been a few here and there that were red, but we'll take it.
So approximately 40 minutes was played.
Well, let's check, Judge. We'll check because they did designate some things on our direct.
38 minutes.
Was ours?
Tell you what. Why don't I just say 35 minutes and then we're done?
That sounds fine.
Okay. How about those four photos?
there's more than four judges, but I've shown them that Mr. Anderson is my understanding there's no objection.
No objection.
Okay, let's get them in evidence.
I'm going to put them in evidence just to be, and to be clear, we need the second page that has the date.
I understand.
Okay.
No objection on that.
Okay. All right, Judge, so do you want just to announce for the record?
Sure.
Okay, ready? It's perfect. Okay, they all are part of 3232, but then there's four digits afterwards identifying the vote. So 3232-0962. 3232-0810 and 0811. 3232-0439 and 0440. 3232-0354, 0355. 3232-0345. 0346, 3232-0365, 0366.
Okay, the court receives into evidence all of the exhibit 3232 pages 0365 through 0366, 0345 through 0346, 0354 through 0355, 0439 through 0440, 0810 through 0811, and 0962. Did I get all that right, Madam Clerk?
And to be clear, Judge, those aren't all photographs. The second page is the date, so that's why there's two pages to some of them.
Okay. Anything else before we take our break?
Nothing to have a plan.
Let's try to keep it to 10 minutes.
All rise. This court is in recess.
Hey, please be seated, everyone. Are we ready to bring in the jury?
Please, sir, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's bring in the jury. Okay, please be seated, everyone. Members of the jury, I want to confirm while you're away, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did no investigation and received no information. Is that all correct?
Correct. Right.
And you've had no contact with anyone about this case. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you haven't seen any media coverage about this case. Well, Mr. Hunter, your next witness, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. In police court, the defense calls Dr. Elliot Crane.
Yes, I do.
Come this way.
Police court. Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you tell us your name, please, sir?
Elliot Crane.
And what is your occupation, Dr. Crane?
I'm a physician.
And where do you presently practice your profession?
Actually, I retired on May 1st, but prior to that, Stanford University at the in the School of Medicine.
Okay. And you retired, when was it, May 1st?
May the 1st.
Okay. And tell us, if you would please, sir, where you received your background, where your education and training to become a physician.
I went to medical school at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, graduating in 1977. And from there, I did pediatric residency at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Following that, an anesthesiology residency at the same hospital, and then a fellowship in pediatric anesthesia and critical care medicine at Boston Children's Hospital. And that was all finishing at the end of 1983.
Are those programs at Massachusetts General and Boston Children's affiliated with Harvard?
Yes, they are.
And did you become board certified?
Yes, I did.
And could you tell the jury what specialties you became board certified in?
First in pediatrics and then anesthesiology. Both of those were in 1985. And then in subsequent years, also not long after that, in pediatric critical care medicine, intensive care medicine. And then after that, in pediatric anesthesiology, once that specialty board was established, which wasn't for a few years, and also pain medicine.
And what have you focused your practice on over the last few decades?
Initially, it was in 1984, it was a combination of pediatric anesthesiology and pediatric critical care medicine. And it wasn't long after that, about 1985, my interest began to shift to pediatric pain management. And that grew as pediatric critical care shrunk. And then it's been largely pediatric pain medicine for the last 25 years.
And where have you had occasion to practice your profession?
After my fellowship training, the first place that I went to work was at the University of Washington, practicing. That was my academic appointment, practicing at the Seattle Children's Hospital. And then about 11 years later, I was recruited to go down to Stanford University, which had a new children's hospital, to be the chief of pediatric anesthesiology and to establish a pediatric anesthesiology group there.
And did you do that?
I did.
Okay. And did there come a point at which you established a pediatric pain clinic at Stanford University?
Yeah, we set up the pain clinic not long after I arrived at Stanford in 1994. And it was a small clinic to begin with, and it grew rapidly over time.
Okay. Tell us what the focus and scope of the pain clinic at Stanford has been over the past 30-some-odd years.
Well, at the beginning, it was a day a week, and then it was 2 days a week and 3 days a week, and it wasn't long before it was 5 days a week. Now we're seeing maybe 11,000 appointments a year, so it's become quite busy. It's a multidisciplinary clinic, so we have on staff pediatric pain medicine specialists. Right now there's seven of them, and pediatric psychologists, also seven. We have pediatric psychology postdoctoral students, four or five of those, physical therapists, and then we also work with occupational therapists and child psychiatry.
And as of 2016 and 2017, what was your role at that clinic?
At that point, that was 7-8 years ago, right? So at that point, I was, at that point, I had pretty much stopped doing pediatric anesthesiology. It was limited to maybe 2 days a month. And not long after that, I stopped altogether. And the rest of my practice was devoted entirely to pain medicine for children.
Okay. And it did at that time, and since you've been involved in it, has the pediatric pain clinic at Stanford dealt with pediatric chronic regional pain syndrome?
Complex regional pain syndrome, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, mispronunciated. To what extent have you been involved in the treatment, in the diagnosis, evaluation, and treatment of pediatric complex regional pain syndrome?
To what extent? Well, we see probably at the present, maybe 100 new cases a year, about two a week, I would say, some weeks more. And we work together as a team, so it isn't as if one physician kind of owns a patient. We share the care of the patient, so I've been involved with all of those patients over the last several decades.
Okay. And what other types of pain syndromes does the pediatric pain clinic at Stanford treat?
We see a little bit of acute pain, so sometimes surgeons will send kids to us postoperatively if they're struggling with their pain management, but primarily it's chronic pain. Chronic pain being defined as pain that's lasted longer than 3 months, usually past the healing of whatever initiated it. So we see a wide spectrum of pain problems. Our referrals come from orthopedic surgeons, general surgeons, urologic surgeons, pediatricians, oncologists. So we see cancer pain. We see a lot of, I'd say, complex regional pain syndrome is one of our most common, maybe the most common diagnoses. Fibromyalgia, chronic headaches, migraine headaches, chronic abdominal pain, especially functional abdominal pain, limb pain disorders. We see kids with congenital birth defects, congenital anomalies that are associated with pain. Even benign tumors, such as fibromatosis, can be associated with pain. So basically, like all of those patients.
Do you also have occasion to deal with patients who have psychogenic pain syndromes?
It's not exactly the term I would use. We have patients whose pain is primarily manifestation of a psychological process. We call that somatoform pain. It's not unlike patients, well, I'll put it this way. There's a number of functional disorders, such as migraine headaches would be considered a functional disorder. In other words, it's functional in the sense that there's no brain tumor or brain infection or anything like that causing the headache, so the child's functional in that sense. There's also functional abdominal pain where the patient has significant abdominal pain, they go to a gastroenterologist, they get a full workup, they get endoscopy, colonoscopy perhaps, nothing is found. They refer the patient to us, so they have a totally functional GI tract, but they have pain. The pain is not in their head, so that's not really psychogenic pain, but we do have patients who present with pain that's not obvious from any other source, or maybe amplified pain, where we know that they have pain from some discrete source, but it's amplified to a much higher degree than one would expect it to be. And we call that somatoform pain. Okay.
During the course of your practice, have you had occasion to contribute to the medical literature regarding pediatric chronic pain?
Yes.
And to what extent have you done that?
I can't give you the number of publications. There are book chapters I've written, or edited one book and written one book on chronic pain, and many articles, but I can't tell you off the top of my head. And, of course, I've lectured dozens and dozens of lectures around the world on the management of different types of chronic pain.
Have you lectured on the subject of complex regional pain syndrome?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
And how often have you done that? Do you have any estimate?
Well, there's 100 to 200 lectures that I've given over the years, some on chronic pain, including complex regional pain syndrome, some exclusively on complex regional pain syndrome, and there are a number of videos that I've made on the subject of CRPS in children.
Okay. Have you had occasion to serve as an editor or reviewer for various medical journals?
Yes, I've been an editor of a journal that's an online journal called Children, a medical journal, and I'm a reviewer for many scholarly journals, such as Pain, the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine, Anesthesia and Analgesia, Anesthesiology, Pediatrics, the Journal of Pediatrics, and others.
Okay. You've been kind enough to give us a copy of your curriculum vitae or your resume. The indication is that your bibliography includes 79 peer-reviewed articles.
Yes,
sir. Sound correct?
That's about right.
Okay. And what is a peer-reviewed article?
A peer-reviewed article is an article that's, or a manuscript that's written up to report the results of research or to summarize a subject that's then sent to a journal and peer-reviewed. Peer-reviewed means that it's sent out anonymously to two or three or four experts in the field internationally. They review the article, they give it a thumbs up, or they give it a thumbs down, or they give it a maybe, with that they'll accept it with alterations or modifications. Then it goes under a revision, and then it's resubmitted, et cetera, until it's finally approved by the peers and then by the editor of the journal.
Okay. Doctor, at my request, have you reviewed probably more materials than you wanted to regarding this case of Maya Kowalski?
I have.
Okay. And I'm going to read from a list of materials that you've told me you've reviewed. I just want you to let the jury know that you've done that.
I will.
Have you reviewed the records of Tampa General Hospital regarding Ms. Kowalski?
Yes.
The records of all Children's Hospital regarding Maya Kowalski?
Yes.
The records of Lurie Children's Hospital?
Yes.
Dr. John Wozenauer's records?
Correct.
Dr. Kirkpatrick's records?
Yes.
Dr. Hanna's records?
Yes.
The records of Agility, PT, and Sports Performance?
Yes.
The Eagles Wing rehabilitation records, or records of?
I believe so, yes.
The records of the Sarasota County School Board?
Don't remember if I've reviewed those, actually.
Okay. Have you reviewed Dr. James Lewis's report?
Yes.
And the report of Dr. Chopra?
Yes.
Dr. Sally Smith's evaluation?
Yes.
The evaluations of both Maya and Beata Kowalski by Tashauna Duncan?
Correct.
And then the depositions of Mr. Kowalski?
Yes.
Dr. Elliott?
Dr. Elliott, yes.
Dr. Wozenauer?
Yes.
Dr. Hanna?
Yes.
And I think I asked you if you reviewed his records. Have you reviewed Dr. Hinschke's records?
I don't remember. Who's he again?
Hinschke? Psychiatrist?
Yes.
Have you reviewed the depositions of Drs. Hanna, Revivo, and Santana Rojas?
Yes.
And the depositions of Dr. Cantu, as well as that of, Dr. Cantu?
Yes.
Okay. Are there other records that you've reviewed regarding the case?
Yes, there are some blog entries by Maya's mother and some emails from Maya's mother to herself. And let me see, what else? Photographs, some photographs of Maya at different times of her life.
Okay. All right. Let me backtrack a bit, if I can, and just ask you some general questions regarding complex regional pain syndrome and some of the other syndromes that bring us together today.
Yep.
Tell the jury, if you would, what chronic regional pain syndrome is from the standpoint of someone who treats that condition in your specialty.
Complex regional pain syndrome.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
I'm sorry.
Complex regional pain syndrome.
A lot of people do that. Because it is a chronic regional pain syndrome. So complex regional pain syndrome means what the words say. It's complex, it's complicated. The cause of it is not known. There are several hypotheses, but over the last decades, we still haven't nailed down exactly what the primary cause is. There's probably a genetic vulnerability that leads to it. It's regional in that it affects a region of the body. Typically, in children, a leg. Typically, in adults, it's an arm, which is mainly a factor of what kids are doing versus what adults are doing. Kids are running around soccer fields and football fields and baseball fields and have leg injuries, very commonly twisted ankles, for example. Whereas adults don't do that, but they'll oftentimes trip and fall and break their fall with an outstretched arm, and that will start it off. It usually follows a rather trivial injury, like a sprain. It can obviously follow a more significant injury like a broken bone. Sometimes it follows surgery. It affects initially one limb of the body that has had the sprain or the operation or the fall or what have you. And it begins at some point after that injury occurs. I have a colleague who's an orthopedic surgeon who gets the RPS repetitively. He's an outdoor runner. He's a trail runner. So he's frequently stepping in gopher holes or snake holes and twisting his ankle. And what he tells me is that all right, I'll skip past that. So at some point in time, it can be days or a week or two after the injury occurs, the pain shifts from the pain of the injury, a twist or ankle or what have you, to what we call neuropathic pain, which is pain that has its origins in the nervous system. Oftentimes, by that point in time, the original injury is healing. And the pain is very different than the kind of throbbing deep pain of a broken bone or a twisted ankle. The pain moves to the surface of the limb, the skin, which has a burning quality. It becomes exquisitely sensitive to touch, even the lightest touch, such as pulling a garment of clothes over that skin, is so excruciating the child can't do it. They can't sleep with bed sheets over their affected leg. They sleep with their leg either dangling off the bed or on top of the bed sheets. And then there's physical findings associated with it as well as the symptoms the child's reporting. Very specific physical findings. This goes on for a length of time until treatment begins.
And what, in your experience, is the... Well, first of all, you've described for us how many cases or an estimate of how many cases the pain clinic at Stanford has seen in the pediatric setting. How frequently does this disease occur in pediatric patients?
Well, most pediatricians will never see a case in their entire career, so it's that infrequent. Consequently, most pediatricians aren't even aware of it or don't know what to do with it. Typically, somebody comes in with this exquisite limb pain, and they'll send the child to an orthopedic surgeon, and most orthopedic surgeons are aware of this problem because it occurs in their practice. And then they'll send the patient on to a pain clinic. Sometimes it's seen by a physical medicine or rehabilitation specialist, sometimes a neurologist. So the frequency is not really known. It's probably on the order of 1 in 100,000 children that get this. But as I said, it's so infrequent that most pediatricians aren't aware of it and will never see it in their lifetime.
How is it that your clinic sees that many patients if it occurs that infrequently?
Well, there's something like 50 million people or 45 million people in the state of California. We're the only multidisciplinary pain clinic in the state of California, the fullest service pain clinic, so we get referrals from all over the state, as well as from neighboring states, Washington, Oregon, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and as far away as the East Coast. We've had patients come to us from Virginia, Boston, Pennsylvania, and we've had patients come to us internationally from various countries in South America, Australia, New Zealand, England, for example. Okay. We get patients from all over because of the reputation that we have.
Okay. And to what extent, well, within the universe of pediatric complex regional pain patients, how many present with so-called whole body CRPS?
None. Nobody does.
And why is that?
Because, as I said, it starts in a limb. It's a regional pain syndrome. It can, in some cases, spread, and it does spread, but not right away, not early in the disease. Usually it's after months or actually more like years. It can affect the opposite limb. It can spread proximally. It can affect an arm. So it can spread, but it typically spreads to other limbs. It doesn't spread to other parts of the body. I can't say why that is, but that's certainly the case.
What is the recognized treatment in your experience for pediatric complex regional pain syndrome?
The most important, the foundation of treatment, the kind of treatment without which it will not get better, is physical therapy and occupational therapy. Occupational therapy is a little bit different than physical therapy. Even though the child doesn't have an occupation, it's still what it's called. But a combination of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and psychotherapy by a qualified psychologist. Those are the fundamental things that will make it better. Everything else, we do other things, of course, But everything else that we do for CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome, is only useful in as much as it supports physical therapy and occupational therapy. So for example, if the child cannot tolerate physical therapy because their limb is so painful, we might add medications to reduce the pain. We can't eliminate the pain, but we can reduce the pain. You might do a nerve block to put that limb to sleep, which is effective for a limited period of time. We can't block the nerve for weeks or months, but we can for days to get the kids started in physical therapy. So the other things that we might do are only useful in as much as they facilitate the practice of physical therapy, without which we can't make patients better.
Is there a role for ketamine in the treatment of pediatric chronic complex regional pain syndrome?
We do use ketamine at Stanford. There's a number of places around the country, a small number of places around the country, that use low-dose ketamine in children. There are still many, if not most, children's hospitals, if they have a pain service, restrict the use of ketamine to the intensive care unit environment in any dose. We have a more liberal hospital, and we were able to convince them that using low-dose ketamine outside the intensive care unit is safe. And it's something that we reserve for refractory cases that we cannot make better after a full-court press, which would be intensive physical therapy every day for weeks, typically 10 or 12 weeks, psychotherapy every day for the same period of time, and using all the drugs that we have on the shelf that are, to some degree, effective in CRPS. If those things don't work, we will then put the child in the hospital for a 5 to 7 day ketamine infusion, but as I said, it's a low-dose ketamine infusion in contrast to what was used in Maya.
While we're on that subject, can you define for the jury a low dose as opposed to a higher dose?
Our ceiling maximum dose is 1 mg/kg/hour, which we've only used in one patient over the last decades. Typically, we start at about 0.1 mg/kg/hour, and we increase the dose every 6 or 8 hours by 0.1 mg/kg/hour until we reach a dose which is effective in reducing pain, or a dose at which unacceptable side effects occur, or a dose at which sedation occurs. And then that becomes our ceiling. So typically our dose is going to be in the range of 0.3 to 0.6 milligrams per kilogram per hour, except for that one patient in whom we had to go to one.
The jury, I think, has heard the term anesthetic dose of ketamine. What is that?
Ketamine, you have to realize, is a drug that has traditionally, conventionally been used as a general anesthetic. You can put somebody to sleep and operate on them with ketamine. The dose that is necessary is a starting dose of about 1 to 2 mg/kg given intravenously. So that would be about 27 milligrams. 50 milligrams in somebody the size that Maya was back then. In an adult, it would be 70, 100, 150 maybe milligrams. And then about 3 mg/kg/hour will keep them asleep in order to do an operation. So you can take somebody's appendix out at 3 mg/kg/hour.
Okay. Now, how does that compare with the dosages that were used in this case by Drs. Kirkpatrick and Hannah?
Objection.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.